Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tovin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host, as always, is Sun political reporter Andrew Doman.
Good morning.
Each year, the U.S. government detains about 400,000 immigrants for various reasons, from establishing their immigration status and eligibility for such provisions as asylum, to holding legal residents that commit crimes, making them eligible for deportation. Immigration and Customs Enforcement spends $2 billion a year on detention, and immigrant advocates are starting to ask whether there are not more humane and economical ways to handle immigrants in legal proceedings. Here in Nevada, the Henderson Detention Center is the primary location for immigrant detention in the state. Through a contract with the federal government, Henderson houses more than 200 immigrants per day on average. Henderson gets $10 to $12 million per year from its detention contract, and $5 to $6 million is profit. A team of students from the UNLV Law Clinic conducted interviews with immigrant detainees through 2013 and recently released a report on conditions at the Henderson Detention Center. Joining us today is UNLV Law Professor who supervised the project, Fatma Maarouf. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
And so first of all, could you describe a little bit more thoroughly, who ends up in immigrant detention? Who needs to be detained by the government?
The purpose of detention is to ensure somebody's appearance at the time of removal. So at the time they want to deport someone, they want to make sure that they can get to that person. The vast majority of people, according to a study that was done between 2002 and 2009, did not have criminal histories, which may be counterintuitive. But they found less than 30% had criminal histories. But people with all different claims, some can be permanent residents who've committed crimes. Some may be seeking different forms of relief in immigration court, such as asylum or cancellation of removal or adjustment of status based on a marriage or some other relationship to a U.S. citizen. So you get a wide variety of people.
So it's possible some people who maybe come to a border, say, and ask for asylum, but that they might be held in detention.
Yeah.
While they wait the determination.
Right. In that situation, the person would be an arriving alien, and a judge would not even have jurisdiction over their bond. To release them on bond. So if ICE denied them bond, there would be no other authority to go to.
So in the immigration system, so ICE gets, in some cases, determines bond, but then in other cases...
ICE always makes the first bond determination, and then the immigrant can challenge that determination in immigration court, but there's large categories of people who are not entitled to have an immigration judge review the bond decision, including arriving aliens.
All right. So, from a legal standpoint, are some people held without bond... an immigrant detention that, would you say normally in like sort of the normal judicial world would be out and be able to sort of maybe just check in with someone
or
sort of be released on their own recognizance? Yeah. Are there different standards, I guess, for immigrants?
The standard is very similar. It's, is the person a danger to the community and a flight risk? But I think it varies a lot from judge to judge in immigration court. So I've definitely seen clients where the judge refused to set a bond, refused to release the person, whereas another judge would have certainly set a bond, perhaps a higher bond, but still set a bond so the person could get out.
And then what rights do immigrants have, when they're in the legal system? Do they get attorneys? How does that work once they're in detention?
So the Fifth Amendment due process applies to immigrants in removal proceedings. There's no right to paid counsel the way there is in criminal proceedings. So you have the privilege of having an attorney, which means if you want one, you want to pay for one, you can have one. But no attorney will be appointed to you. There's a big difference between immigration and criminal proceedings in terms of how much protection you get.
And so tell us a little bit about the project from the UNLV Law Clinic that you supervise. How did it get started? What was the sort of the methodology and system they used to, what did you set out to do?
Well, so... we began inquiring about detention conditions because of various reports we'd received from different people. Some clients would call and complain about their phone calls being monitored or not getting their legal mail from us or having it shuffled around, that kind of thing. And we were aware nationwide of problems in detention, so it was certainly on our radar. So we had students, a group of students over two semesters basically interview 29 detainees. In some cases, we gave them advice about their removal proceedings. In one case, we're still representing the individual. And we also asked questions about the conditions of their detention, and we saw patterns emerging. And so our report basically compiles what we found. And the report accounts for how many people mentioned which types of violations, so people can make their own judgments who read it about whether they think it's a serious or pervasive problem or not. But the ones that we're most concerned to me, were coercion and signing, verbal abuse using various racial slurs, very poor conditions in the holding cells and in transportation of detainees to and from court or to and from ICE holding cells, limited access to a law library, sometimes only in the middle of the night, very delayed medical care, waiting weeks or months to see a doctor, those types of things.
So, and this is Andrew from The Sun. Mm-hmm. This is happening right over here in Henderson, our backyard, and it was one of those things that in the recession they went forward with the expansion of the detention center specifically for this reason, so that the city could make money basically from the federal government for housing immigration detainees. Is there a way to fix some of these issues that are going on and also preserve this as a revenue generator for the city?
Certainly the issues can be fixed and the city can keep its contract with ICE. But I think the more troubling issue for me at least is that taxpayers are paying, we're all paying with our federal tax dollars, right, for the cost of detention. And there are much cheaper ways to accomplish the same goals. Alternatives to detention cost anywhere from 70 cents to $17 a day. That's things like requiring people to report weekly, monthly, whatever's required, sometimes in where people have severe criminal offenses, giving them an ankle bracelet. Those things are much cheaper than actually housing them in a detention facility. And studies have shown a 94% compliance rate when alternative forms of detention are used. So just the fact that we continue to detain people to make money off of our jail system is quite disturbing when there's other ways to get people to show up in court and to show up at the time of deportation that aren't costly.
If studies have shown that there is a pretty good, higher than 90% success rate with these alternatives, and they are less expensive, why aren't we doing that?
I think because keeping prisons has become a business in the United States. It employs people. It makes money for the city, whereas these other alternative forms don't do that.
So is there anyone out there, you know, certainly with this report, that's something that's now out there, but are there groups, are there people involved politically who are saying maybe there's a cheaper alternative out here?
Yeah, certainly. A lot of immigrants' rights organizations have called for greater use of alternatives to detention. Also, this quota of 34,000 beds a day is in total tension with the priorities that ICE has set at the national level about who should be detained. It seems like we're filling our detention centers with people who really should not even be deported because under ICE's priorities are not a high priority for deportation. We have 12 million people. We can't deport all of them.
But there's actually a quota in statute?
I don't know if it's in statute, but it's certainly been reported.
So I believe it's part of the appropriations bill for Department of Homeland Security and then ICE underneath the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. It's a congressional mandate. They call it the bed mandate. And so it started somewhere below 34,000, I think in like the mid-2000s, like 2006. But now funding for ICE is directly tied to ICE fulfilling this mandate, which is now 34,000 beds per day. Something I wanted to get at with you. What's sort of the history of our detention standards and what crimes lead to detention and what violations lead to detention? I understand, right? It was in 1996 started... Mm-hmm. I guess at that point there was a pattern of making things stricter, right, and detaining more and more people.
Exactly. So there were several statutes passed in 1996 that dramatically expanded the grounds for detention. We also have grounds for mandatory detention, which means the judge doesn't have authority to review the detention of a person. So the judge can't review a bond decision or a denial of bond. So people who had pled guilty to crimes before 96 retroactively became deportable. At the time they pled guilty, they had no idea that plea would make them deportable, and then Congress passed these new laws and retroactively applied them. So a single shoplifting offense committed within 5 years, even if the person isn't 5 years of entry to the U.S. after becoming, this is for somebody who's a lawful permanent resident, so not somebody who's undocumented, that person can be deportable. So relatively minor crimes can result in deportation. And then whether or not to detain someone is totally ICE's discretion, and it's reviewed by an immigration judge, and a lot of it turns on the judge.
And then after 9/11, the rules got even stricter, right, in terms of immigration standards and who would be detained and maybe whatnot. And so then when did we start? It seems like there was a period where at least through memorandums from ICE management or from, you know, the the president himself, mm-hmm. the prosecutorial discretion, mm-hmm. that pattern sort of take backtrack, right? That we sort of started mm-hmm. to walk that back. When did that start?
That was in June of 2011 that those memoranda came down.
And so, so since then, have you seen improvements in terms of using discretion on who really is a threat to the community, who can be released?
The national statistics are like less than 2% of cases has the government actually exercised prosecutorial discretion. This is people who are in removal proceedings, who are facing deportation. Only rarely is the government actually deciding not to pursue their cases because they're not a priority. And so it's something that immigration lawyers are fighting daily.
Is it that there's still too many mandated detainable offenses that ICE still doesn't have enough discretion under the law, or is it that they're just not using the discretion?
No, they're not using their discretion. They definitely, there's lots of cases where they have discretion, but pretty much even a single DUI, they're treating as a serious offense. And
I found that curious in Tovin's story. I think there was someone who had basically overstayed a visa, mm-hmm. sort of committed, I guess, what would be more of a civil offense. This mm-hmm. person hadn't. This is maybe oversimplifying it, but this person didn't mm-hmm. appear to be a quote-unquote bad guy mm-hmm. who needed to be locked up and kept away mm-hmm. from children or mm-hmm. you know, otherwise detained. Why has it been the policy to put those people behind bars rather than
Yeah, so somebody detention? Like that should be released on bond. So why ICE would deny bond to a person like that, I have no idea. Sometimes the reason they denied is if they don't think the person has any relief. So if they think there's nothing you can apply for to legalize your status here, then you don't have an incentive to come back to court once they release you. So in those cases, even if you're not a criminal, they will keep you detained because they think you're going to be ordered deported and they want to make sure they can get their hands on you.
Oh, so they might think, okay, this person is going to realize that they really don't have – they've been caught and they don't have any way exactly. out. So if they're released – they might just run. They're like right. a flight risk at
so,
that point.
Exactly. The two things they look at are flight risk and danger to community. So even if somebody's not a danger, if they're at flight risk, they will detain them.
And so let's talk a little bit about what you specifically found. I mean, what, in terms of the law library is mm-hmm. one thing you mentioned. They're supposed to have access mm-hmm. to a law library, research their own case. And as we said, so I took my own tour of the Henderson mm-hmm. Detention Center, and they have their LexisNexis computers. So they have mm-hmm. one computer, and they can use this mm-hmm. database, LexisNexis, to search legal records. Mm-hmm. And so as a lawyer, for the average person out there, what is LexisNexis, and how easy mm-hmm. is it to use or not easy?
I think it would be very difficult. Plus, you don't have a sense of understanding of case law if you're not a lawyer, I don't think. You wouldn't know what cases to look at or how to search them. You know, the updated standards specifically provide for people who have lower English proficiency to get help using the law library, but because they're applying these old 2000 standards, those provisions aren't there. So, yeah, it would be very difficult not only to use the computer, but in HDC, what we've heard is that there's no photocopy machine. Whenever you file something in court, you must serve the government. You need copies. If you want to keep a copy for yourself of what you filed, there's no printer. So if somebody wants to print out a report, a human rights report for an asylum case, and there's no ink, they can't file anything. Mm-hmm. So they really, it's like litigating their cases with their hands tied. They don't have the resources to litigate their cases.
And then I guess some of the interviewees suggested that they only had access at late night hours.
Right.
Right? Was it between midnight and 7 a.m.?
Right. Anything? That really surprised us. I think it was between like 10 and 5 in the morning or something like that. And half the women, three of the women we talked to and a couple of the men said that. So, and then we also had some people being told, you don't have a case anyway, so don't bother doing legal research. Which, you know, to somebody who doesn't know the system, that might put them off.
Right. And then there were also issues with, as you said, it wasn't necessarily all Henderson, but also some just interactions with mm-hmm. ICE, in that some of the detainees who were interviewed, so just they were physically coerced mm-hmm. or maybe just verbally right. coerced into signing documents mm-hmm. they didn't understand. Mm-hmm. So what kind of documents are we talking mm-hmm. about? You know, and what sort of the issue? What kind of abuses were they reporting?
Often when ICE picks somebody up, they'll give them a chance to just do a voluntary departure right away without even going to immigration court. So we think some of the documents involved, whether or not the person wants to actually see a judge or not. Now, if they choose to see a judge, then that means they might be detained and they might some people want to leave right away and don't want to sort of deal with the detention system. And others want to stay, but they have to make an informed decision about that. And what we saw was ICE, what we heard about, and it was just some instances, but of ICE rushing people. Well, more commonly, everybody was sort of rushing them through, being yelled at. But the physical coercion we saw in just a couple incidents, but it was very disturbing, where people's arms, you know, thumbprints were physically forced as signatures.
And then there was also issues in terms of phone calls and mm-hmm. mail and access. Mm-hmm. So where were you? Was it from your own clients about?
So before we even started this work, I had certainly since I've been here received complaints about that. Nobody seems to think that there is an unmonitored phone. Mm-hmm. HDC, I read in the article in The Sun, says it is labeled, but. And maybe it is. I haven't seen it with my own eyes, but the detainees certainly don't know which one it is. So it's not labeled in a way that they understand which one it is. And I've also been told to use just the phone in the waiting area. It's a sort of a video conference with my clients, and that's not a private room. Anybody can overhear the conversation. So that violates attorney-client privilege and confidentiality rules.
And then once something that came up in my reporting for the story in The Sun from Tuesday was that they, as you said earlier, they're only Henderson Detention Center is only held to a set of detention standards mm-hmm. established in 2000. They've since been revised in 2008 and 2011. Mm-hmm. So, what are some of the differences? What does that mean mm-hmm. exactly in
yeah.
terms of the differences?
So, there were four standards added in 2008, from what I've seen. One was on sexual abuse and assault, and that was a specific because those standards were a response to cases being. Documented about that happening widely in some cases. So sexual abuse and assault. Another one was about detainee searches, when they can strip search, when they can do a cavity search, who has to be present. You know, the idea that if it's an opposite gender search, then a staff member of the same gender has to be present. That reasonable suspicion has to be there if it's a strip search. You know, one of the problems we encountered interviewing is that some of the people were worried about meeting with us in a private room, a contact visit, which is what we prefer because it's totally confidential. Because if they have a contact visit, then they get strip searched without reasonable suspicion. So it's like meet with your attorney or choose a strip search. Meet with your attorney privately and get strip searched, or don't meet with your attorney privately. And that's not really a fair choice. So strip searches. The other one was staff training. There was a new, very detailed policy on what types of training have to be provided for staff members at different levels, you know, with different roles in this facility. And I think that would address many of the issues in terms of lack of professionalism and how they talk to detainees, being aware of culturally sensitive issues, working specifically with women or transgender detainees. I think all of those things need to be addressed through staff training. And then the last one was about news and media and tours, actually, and they had a new revised policy on that. And then in 2011, we saw many improvements to medical care and mental health care. So in medical care, for the first time, they addressed a policy for women, specifically talking about during pregnancy, during labor, not shackling them, you know, obstetric and gynecological care. There were specific provisions for people with HIV in terms of getting tests whenever they wanted to have a test done in terms of confidentiality of the results. They had provisions about 24-hour response to sick calls instead of a 48-hour response, and also about having to have somebody who speaks the same language. So people of limited English would have to be given medical care by somebody they can actually communicate with, because a lot of rapes weren't being reported because people couldn't communicate.
How do these standards compare to, because I think the Henderson Detention Center is kind of interesting because it has this component that is run by immigration and it also has the local jail. Mm-hmm. So how mm-hmm. do those standards for people who aren't citizens mm-hmm. compare to the other side of the mm-hmm. jail?
One of the interesting things with the sexual assault policy is that it's actually a lower standard from immigration detainees than, women in the sort of federal Bureau of Prison system have greater protections than women in the immigration detention system who may have no criminal record. So that's one bizarre thing. They're not always, the immigration detainees don't always have as much protection as the criminal federal inmates do.
So they're almost like
they're second class status.
Right. So they're not, but mm-hmm. I mean, we use the cliche sort of second class citizen, but in this case, they're not citizens, so they're not afforded some of the same protections.
It's one of the paradoxes of immigration law is that what's at stake is so high. It's your ability to stay in the country, right? Your separation potentially from your family, from your children, from your job, from the only country you've known, maybe. And yet the amount of protection we offer is so low compared to what we offer in criminal cases. So the punishment, deportation is not considered punishment, and that's why you don't get all the due process rights you get in a criminal proceeding. But for many people, and the Supreme Court has even acknowledged that it's a penalty worse than punishment. So somebody who's facing 6 months in jail versus somebody who's facing deportation, I would argue the deportation is the more severe penalty.
I'm curious, just thinking about in a broader context, when we talk about deportation and these detainees, how do other countries do it? Is the United States unique in any way?
Well, other countries also have a lot of problems with immigration and a lot of anti-immigration sentiment in Europe. Europe has moved towards like a unified asylum system now. So in terms of asylum, the U.S. takes more asylees than any country in the world except South Africa. So among developed countries, we are the number one destination for asylum seekers. So in that sense, the U.S. is unique and is welcoming in a way. You know, every country has its own system, and so there's huge variation, you know, in how people are detained. We're certainly not alone in the problems we see in detention centers. I think we see that in Europe, in Australia, and other developed countries as well.
Are those countries... detaining people at such high rates? Are they? We spoke a little earlier about some of these alternatives to detention, including maybe an ankle bracelet, stuff like home detention, things like that. Are other countries putting people behind bars at such high rates?
Some of them are. Some of them worse than the U.S., but not all. So it varies a lot. And like Israel, until very recently, detained everyone even after they were. So while they were seeking asylum, even after, if the courts decided that they would be tortured in their country, Israel wouldn't deport them, but it kept them in jail indefinitely. So we don't do that. Like if they're granted torture protection, they're released. So there are countries that are worse than us, and there are countries that are much better.
And it should be mentioned, so ICE has said that in terms of the detention standards, when I contacted them about that, they said that they sort of started rolling out the higher standards from 2011 with their bigger facilities. Some of their facilities house only detainees and would have populations over 1,000 each day. And so they said that they're sort of going from the top down. Was their response, and that they, and both Henderson and ICE have said that they're reviewing the report and plan to address the concerns raised. And that brings us to the reaction that you've gotten, you know, in terms of your response when you gave them the report. What's been the response from ICE and Henderson and your communications with them?
So we met with ICE yesterday, but it was really just about student access. And I think we've worked out that issue, and they agree that students should be allowed in. And we discussed when and how students should be allowed in, because there was a sudden change in the rules for letting students in after we released the report. So I think we're going to be okay on that front. But in terms of all the other substantive parts of our report, they just said higher-ups and ICE are reviewing it. So we haven't gotten any concrete feedback, nor has the city given us any concrete feedback on the substance of the report.
Right. You went before the city council this week and asked for, I guess, a response, you know, to look into these issues. And so I take it you have not heard anything back yet?
No, not on any of the issues we've raised, no.
Okay. I was curious about that, too. Has there been anyone, as you're over at UNLV, this concerns the detention center over in Henderson, have there been any local leaders, community leaders, or political figures who have sort of taken this up as an issue now that you've released this report looking at some of the problems?
Not yet, not that I know of, but I think that would be our next step here. We haven't specifically asked anybody to take it up, but there are certainly individuals that we could speak to and plan to speak to.
Now, your report coincided with a sort of nationwide report from the Detention Watch that it included information from your report about Henderson Detention Center, but also detention in general across the country and some other specific examples. I think in one detention center in Arizona, two people committed suicide this year, and there's been 9 deaths total across the system. And so none of those have been in Henderson. Mm-hmm. And not to say that the issues you've raised in your report aren't serious, but it... I guess, is it wrong to say that, I mean, it seems like these problems in Henderson are fixable, right?
I would agree.
And so is it just that you want to work with them and make sure that everything's sort of up to standard and it could move forward possibly, you know.
Right. At this stage, I think that's still where we're at, is trying to work with them. If they don't want to work to improve these conditions, then I think we need to think about what the next step would be. But at this stage, we're really hoping, because there's no reason not. We have the same goals. They want a compliant detention center to keep their contract with ICE, and we want a compliant detention center to protect the detainees. So there's really no reason for us to be at loggerheads with each other. But instead of acknowledging and trying to address this, we've just faced silence.
So, and you had meetings, right? With Henderson City Council
I spoke to the City Council. Yeah, they didn't really respond. So, yeah.
And have you spoken to other officials at the detention center or the federal immigration officials?
So we met with ICE yesterday, and they didn't want to talk about the substance of the report. They just said it was being reviewed. We only talked about student access. We've requested a meeting with the detention center superintendent in mid-October. We have not yet gotten a meeting.
Sort of looking forward, there was obviously this year was a big year where immigration reform was on the table, and the Senate passed a bill. It looks like it's a little stalled out now. But from your perspective, what could an immigration reform bill or groups of bills include that would help alleviate some of these problems and maybe provide more discretion, or what could be done legislatively to make detention work better?
Well, so if there is a legalization, some type of legalization program, many of these folks will have some type of path to legal status, even if it's a very long path. And so there'd be no point in us detaining them now, because they'd eventually be getting out under the reform and have something they could apply for. So we're detaining people now who may ultimately be allowed to stay here, and it's just a waste of taxpayer money.
Because you said earlier that sometimes they'll detain people who have just overstayed a visa, who aren't a threat to society, but they'll detain them basically recognizing that these people are a flight risk because they have no legal basis
to
stay. Exactly,
so now they would have a legal basis.
Now they would have a legal basis to stay, and therefore that sort of reason to be behind bars would go away.
Right.
So immigration reform, if it was passed, if there was a pathway to citizenship, we might see just a dramatic drop in the number of people detained.
We should see a dramatic drop.
And is there talk about sort of adding discretion to maybe, you know, in bond hearing, that sort of things, that people who aren't eligible for bond or people who must be brought in and detained?
So the courts are doing this more than the legislature right now. So the Ninth Circuit passed a decision called Rodriguez v. Robbins that actually, it used to be people subject to mandatory detention could be detained indefinitely. And now, at least before removal order. So if their case went on 5 years, they were detained 5 years. Recently, the Ninth Circuit ruled that 6 months, even if the person is subject to mandatory detention, they get a bond hearing. So that means the judge can review it once they've been detained 6 months. And we'd really like to see that decision being implemented here. We don't think it's being implemented at all. So my personal next step is to request a group meeting at HDC to talk to the detainees as a group, give them some legal education about this decision, who might be eligible. We see lots of people. There's dozens of people there who've been there longer than 6 months. Not all of them may be eligible under Rodriguez, but I'm sure some of them are, and they just don't know that they can get out. So that's our next step.
What's of the people you interviewed, I mean, how long were some of the ones who've been there the longest? What are we talking about for
some detention? Of them are still there, so they've probably been there a couple years at this point.
Wow, in detention, just waiting for their court cases to play out, basically.
Right. Many court cases can take years.
Yeah. All right, well, thank you for joining us. We've been talking with Fatma Marufa, a UNLV law professor who headed up a project looking into conditions at the Henderson Detention Center for immigrant detainees. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Our producer is Richard Riegel. My co-host is Andrew Doman, and I'm Tobin LePan. See you next week.